The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. I'm Seth. It's Wednesday, March 20th. Our phone number, should you like to join us, is 602-508-0960. Hope you're having a safe drive home from work. And if you work the late shift, mutatis mutandis, a safe drive to the office or the plant or wherever it is you punch in. We're talking about a lot of things today, from education to mainstay democratic institutions like the Electoral College and electoral processes. I'm going to go to Hal in just a moment. I just had to point out a quote I saw Kristen Gillibrand, candidate for president, New York senator, U.S. senator from the state of New York, say, talking about illegal immigration. I love how they changed the terms on us so they can win the debate. She was asked about her views on illegal immigration. Her line was, there's no such thing as an illegal human. And, of course, the crowd rose in applause. No one argues that there's no such thing as an illegal human, except perhaps the abortion industry. Outside of that, no one has ever said anything like illegal human. They changed the language. They changed the language so that they can win the debate. Of course, to use the phrase, the wording illegal alien is infradig and even forbidden in certain places, of course, classrooms, college classrooms. It's undocumented, and it's always undocumented worker, even though teams of them, millions of them, are not working. Hal is in Prescott. Hi, Hal.
Seth, how are you doing? I have two quick comments. You know, our friend Senator Gillibrand.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as an illegal human, but what she does believe in, and the rest of them, the Democrats believe in, is that some people are outside of the protection of the law.
Yes, you know, I was saying, in fact, ask the abortion rights advocates if they believe in illegal humans or not. Yeah, no, it's a very odd construction for her to run with. I suppose she's just trying to out-clever the other Democrats. You know, they're all kind of doing this now. It's kind of fun to watch as they create these neologisms and new words and phrases. They're all trying to out-cute the other one, you know. Beto O'Rourke does this famous social media a scene of him going to the dentist. Today, Kristen Gillibrand had a scene of her bench pressing dumbbells. So, you know, I mean, it's just kind of funny to watch the crassness of this stuff.
It has never been so easy to assign a nickname to a politician. Dumbbell. My question is, the reason why I called in is, you know, you guys have been talking about this deconstruction of the Electoral College.
Yes,
which is
right,
what this is.
Right.
And so, you know, the Democrats seem to be very good at getting these nationwide injunctions on, you know, we don't like Trump's hair color.
Yeah.
They can use a different color, whatever it might
whatever
be.
Whatever it might
so
be.
So why don't Republicans actually, you know, if there are any competent lawyers in the Republican Party, do something, find a judge that believes in the Constitution exists and that the Electoral College is part of that, and get a nationwide injunction against this nonsense, as opposed to sit around, and this is what we'll do, just like we waited for bad things to lose all the elections in California to their ballot harvesting strategy that they very kindly wrote into the law for us so that we would miss it, I guess. And, you know, so what do we have to do? Do we have to lose an election because of this effort that they're making and then enjoy the tyranny of the majority before we say, oh, wait, maybe we should do something about that?
It is.
I mean, do I have to go to law school?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean,
seriously. See, the idea, so Hal, really, the idea was that none of us should have had to go to law school. That was the original idea of the founders. They created something that we pretty much all thought we understood. You know, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion nor prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Pretty simple. Pretty simple. Turns out, no, not in the hands of the left it isn't, nor prohibiting free speech. Pretty simple. Not in the hands of the left it isn't. You know, all of these constitutional provisions, strictures, They were meant so that we could all kind of understand them and abide by them. One of the points I really want to underscore about the Electoral College that I just think it's really neat to think about when you think about the genius and the virtue of the framers. And then I'll come around to your point about protecting the Electoral College. But when they created this this plan, when they created what has become known as the Electoral College, the first the delegates to the Constitutional Convention, you know, think about it again. Think about it. All of these men, they were men at the time, all of these men pretty much knew that it was from among that group that we would be getting U.S. senators and presidents. And yet they were so distrustful of power, they were so distrustful of tyrannies of the majorities, that they put that limiting principle of an Electoral College plan together, even as it would probably work against themselves. I just think that goes to their virtue and their brilliance at the same time. It's kind of an interesting thing to me. I just think it's a beautiful thing, quite frankly. That having been said, yeah, why couldn't we propose a sense of the Congress resolution guarding what the 12th Amendment, I guess it would be, as well as Section 4 of Article 1 of the Constitution, which guarantees free elections and Congress's ability to step in where states run riot or roughshod over them. Who knew we would have to do such a thing? But yeah, perhaps we do have to do such a thing.
Yeah, everything is on the table, and I don't know if literally everything.
Yeah, literally everything.
Your ability to look at what Lois Lerner did to the people in the Tea Party. Your ability to participate in politics on an equal basis under the law does not matter to these people. And if they have the tyranny of the majority, there is no limit to the insanity that they will dream up, because they need a continuous revolution. And they always need something to keep the mob, the Antifa people and the rest of the Twitter mob and all these other people agitated, to distract them from the fact that they're getting ripped off and screwed by socialism. You know,
this is why I have no patience for Republican Never Trump movements and activists. They do not get your point, which I totally appreciate, get, absorb, and adopt. There is an existential attack on this country, excuse me, on its politics, on its institutions, on its constitution. And there is a very thin line between its preservation and its disappearance totally. Think about that. I just don't get what people who don't support this president from the position of being a Republican or at least a fair or moderate-minded independent, I don't know who they think they're helping. They're helping the effort of the left and of the progressives to further destroy everything we knew of our constitutional republic. It is an existential threat you're describing. I get it. I don't know why others don't. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, the problem of the Flight 92, Republican as opposed to Flight 93, is big, and it's in order to maintain patience when speaking with them to try and convince them of the sense of urgency here.
Well, this is why I don't know if you were around. I might have been in my first hour yesterday. You know, I was talking about Dennis Prager made a list of 20 things or so that the left destroys. And I read it because you think about it. All of this is what's really on the table here. You want me to do the list real quick? I can do it real quick. Religion, immigration, sports, music, art, literature, the family, children, universities, high schools, elementary schools, race relations, human dignity, America, liberty, civility, the Boy Scouts, economics, cheapening of evil, moral character, late night TV. I would add San Francisco and Seattle. Those are hugely important things, some cultural, some political, some familial, and it's through politics that they have destroyed all these things, except for late night TV, I think. It's through politics that they have destroyed all these things, and it's through through politics that we're going to be able to save and restore them. People who don't get that get nothing.
Yeah, if you look at Seattle, what you have, hygiene, basic public hygiene has saved more lives than all the doctors, medicines, and hospitals ever. Basic hygiene. Seattle is failing at basic hygiene. You watch 5 minutes of video, and what else do you need to know? So we have medieval diseases coming back in Los Angeles. If you do not, if you are unable to achieve basic public hygiene, you are going to fail at everything else.
Can I read you something? I'm glad you brought this up. Every once in a while, I quote the great novelist Tom Wolfe in an essay he wrote called The Great Relearning, circa 1987, right on this very point, because it's basically a start from zero movement, a great unlearning of everything we have been, you know, taught and learned through the miracle of science and education. I'm going to a break. Can you stay? I want to read some of this to you. It's
sure.
Right on point to what you're saying, this idea of basic hygiene. Do you have a few minutes?
I sure do.
We'll be right back. I'm Seth Leibson. Coming up, Tom Wolfe on The Great Relearning. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. I'm talking to Hal and Prescott, who brought up this just thing that I am consumed with. Hal, you were talking about, you and I were talking about, you know, great cities that have been destroyed or are being destroyed in our very midst. San Francisco's one, I think. Seattle. And it sounded like you knew something of this. There's this documentary going around. I don't know if you've seen it. Called Seattle is Dying, and it's done by KOMO News in Seattle. A reporter up there did this two-part series called Seattle is Dying. The second one, Demon at the Door, and it's about, you know, what heroin is doing in the city. And as he writes on the website, it's about citizens who don't feel safe taking their families into downtown Seattle. It's about parents who won't take their children to the public parks they pay for. It's about filth and degradation all around us, and theft and crime, and people who don't feel protected anymore, who don't feel like their voices are being heard. And see, in San Francisco, you have this issue. We're now paying up to $180,000. Yes, that's the number, to people who go around picking up human feces throughout the city. And then you, Hal, we're talking about, you know, this basic concept known as hygiene. Lest you think that this is accidental, it's not. Tom Wolfe, the novelist, wrote a piece in 1987 called The Great Relearning. And if you will stand it, I will just read a little bit of it to you. I just think it's great. Can I?
Please do.
In 1968 in San Francisco, I came across a curious footnote to the psychedelic movement. At the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic, there were doctors who were treating diseases no living doctor had ever encountered before, diseases that had disappeared so long ago they had never even picked up Latin names, diseases such as the mange, the grunge, the itch, the twitch, the thrush, the scruff, the rot. And how was it that they had now returned? It had to do with the fact that thousands of young men and women had migrated to San Francisco to live communally in what I think history will record as one of the most extraordinary religious experiments of all time. The hippies, as they became known, sought nothing less than to sweep aside all codes and restraints of the past and start out from zero. At one point, Ken Kesey even organized a pilgrimage to Stonehenge with the idea of returning to Anglo-Saxon civilization's point zero, which he figured was Stonehenge, and heading out all over again to do it better. I could go on, but this is the point you were making, wasn't it?
That's exactly it, and that is a wonderful essay. It's been a while since I've looked at it, but boy, it seems like it's time to reread it.
Oh, absolutely.
Time to brush up on some of those diseases.
Absolutely. They're coming back, aren't they, Hal? They're coming back.
Yeah.
Things
yeah,
we thought we got rid of.
And everything else from the 70s.
Yeah, things we thought we got rid of a long time ago, including whooping cough, gosh knows. That's back too, evidently.
Well, when you have somebody who manufactures data, and this is how corrupt our civilization is. You know, this man, this anti-vaccination movement,
yeah.
The doctor, I forget his name.
I know who you mean. I know the one that gets cited and the one who was thrown out of practice.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. It was reported that he divorced his wife and is now dating Elle McPherson. I don't know if that's true, but that shows you how corrupt celebrity culture is.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
People are dying. You know, children, babies, infants cough so hard that they break ribs.
Right.
When they're ill for weeks. So, you know, problems that have been solved are going to come back again because history begins the day we were born.
Yeah. Yeah, this great unlearning that has taken place that gives us the need for this great relearning. I think we're seeing a lot of it. frankly, in this area of substance abuse. I mean, there's a lot of surrender in this area, just a ton. By the way, I think Starbucks is kind of thinking again on how, rethinking, you know, the wisdom of Howard Schultz's decision to just let anyone use their bathrooms, because there was this story of these Starbucks employees that are tired of cleaning out, you know, the bathrooms with used syringes in them, God knows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, I mean, and actually, I mean, you're talking hepatitis C.
Yep.
Easily transmissible, you know, even if you, a very tiny amount. I mean, it's, you know, that's a major health hazard for those people. Those medicines are very expensive. It's kind of ridiculous. I mean, that is stuff that actually people with specialized training need to clean up. And, you know, with those types of things that are, that may be contaminated like that. So, you know, put a Sharps container in your Starbucks bathroom. You know, just in case people want to dispose of their.
I'm seeing them in hotels, in hotel bathrooms now, Hal. I'm seeing them in
hotel bathrooms now. That's for people with insulin.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, the heroin addicts could also, you know, obviously there's probably enough heroin addicts now that we've ignored the drug war for 40 years, and deaths are seven times as high as when Bill Bennett was trying to fix things.
Let me say a word on that, by the way, because your numbers aren't far wrong. I've been doing a lot of research on this. Hal, this is a huge issue that I'm going to plan to spend a lot more time on. But let's start with a myth. And a major myth is that the policies of prevention, pushing back and reducing use, what some people will call quote-unquote drug wars, failed and didn't work. It's a lie. It's a lie. From 1979 to 1992, we took the issue really, really seriously, and we reduced drug use in this country from 14.1% at its high in 79 to 5.8% in 1992. That's the lowest we've ever gotten it, 5.8%. We worked a lot of different avenues. We worked a lot of different efforts, and we reduced drug use by more than 60%. More than 60%. That's a huge public policy success. Guess what? We're back nearly to where we were with the origins of the crisis. Right now, the population of regular drug users is 11.2%, nearly a 100% increase since our greatest victory, which is basically a 100% loss. That's the failure.
Mm-hmm. And the drugs are much more potent.
Much more potent. Much more potent.
You know. People.
Mm-hmm. No. Well, let me give you scale. People remember the crack epidemic and the crack crisis. We are losing now more people to cocaine than we were then. We are now losing more people to drug and substance abuse overdose than we were to AIDS in its worst year. Now, if AIDS was a crisis, and it was, what do you call this? What do you call this if we're losing 70,000 a year when in 1995, during AIDS' worst year, we lost 50,000? We need a new thesaurus, maybe a new dictionary.
Mm-hmm. Well, and a lot of people who, you know, really pushed for this type of program against cigarettes and continue to push for it, you know, may kind of, you know, poo-poo. I'm not speaking about San Francisco. The, you know, the use of this type of serious public effort against drug use. But they think it worked for cigarettes.
You could be my speechwriter. I mean, this is exactly where my brain was going, Hal. We know how to do this. We had a massive public campaign against cigarettes, a prevention campaign, because people thought then maybe prevention worked. And it did. We reduced cigarette smoking by 50% in this country. There's a great study out of CVS Pharmacies. You know, they banned the sale of cigarettes. They stopped selling cigarettes. In the cities where CVSs are located, 93 million fewer packs of cigarettes are sold. Don't tell me availability is not the mother of use. Why do we take everything we learned about cigarettes and everything we learned about forest fires and say, ah, yeah, well, with drugs it won't work? Of course it will.
Yep. Well, there's a lot of powerful interests that want to get people addicted to marijuana.
You bet there are. It's big bucks. It's big bucks.
Massive corruption.
And the kids will lose. Hal, God bless you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Seth.
I'm Seth Leibson, 602-508-0960. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show, 602-508-0960. Paul is in Gilbert. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Seth, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I think we were just talking, you were just talking about the drugs and the problems we're having, and all everything's in front of our eyes, if I'm not mistaken. You know, you think we have a good neighbor to the south of us, Mexico? I think we got a corrupt, filthy country below us, okay? And every time they say they help us, they don't help us. Every time they stop people, they bust people, okay? It's a double standard. The stuff's getting old. It's getting old.
Thanks, Paul. We've got a we do have a huge problem with our neighbors to the south. We have some problems with our neighbors to the north. We have some problems with China, all of which are contributing to the drug problem, a huge one. And look, it's twofold. We can address it internationally, and we can address it domestically. I think probably in all the political statements that Hillary Clinton has ever made, there's only one I agree with, and she was absolutely right about this. We can do everything we can and should do everything we can to work with Mexico on going after the cartels, the way we worked with Colombia, by the way, in the 1980s and 1990s. We could do it then. We need a new and serious effort with Mexico, obviously. But we also, you know, that's on the supply side, but we also have a demand problem. And if there weren't consumers here, if there weren't consumers here, there wouldn't be a supply here. And we have given up on that side of the fight, too. That's the reason I'm so involved in prevention. What was that great series I love? I loved. It started, do you remember? It was the one about how the drug, you know the one, Bill. Yes, Narcos. And the narrator says at the opening of the series, he says, he's narrating from the perspective of a drug dealer of a burgeoning cocaine cartel in Colombia coming to Miami. He says when we first got to Miami, there was a demand problem. After a few short months of our arrival there, we saw a supply problem, and that's everything you need to know. It's both. It's both. It's a lot of cash, to be made. And a lot of bodies and souls that are being destroyed. A lot. 70,000 deaths last year. 70,000. And that's just, you know, the extreme of it. The deaths, obviously, the worst of it. We're not talking about ruined lives. We're not talking about workplace accidents. We're not talking about roadside accidents. We're not talking about cycles and cycles and cycles of rehab. We're not talking about and recovery. We're not talking about broken families. We're not talking about foster care. I mean, all of it, all of it. It's costing this country a fortune, a fortune. I've seen numbers that run as high as $700 billion a year on this. Again, not even counting the emotional cost, not even accounting the emotional cost. But, okay, I got a few emails asking what was that Tom Wolfe story I was telling you about. It's a story. You can get it online. It's an article he wrote for the American Spectator in 1987, and it's called The Great Relearning by Tom Wolfe. Wolfe is W-O-L-F-E, The Great Relearning. And it's about these movements of starting back to zero. We may get another hint of that, by the way. I was noting we're going to be treated to a lot of this coming closer and closer to the summertime, the 50th anniversary of Woodstock. And I'm noticing more and more, you know, stories about that. And how they're going to try and recreate Woodstock. I don't know if it's such a great idea. There are more people who said they were at Woodstock than were actually at Woodstock. But be prepared for that, too. Talk about a great relearning. You know, it wasn't exactly just a concert. There was a lot of turmoil, a lot of ruin, and a lot of sickness that came out of that experiment as well. Some things are best left to history and best not trying to be recreated, especially, as Hal said, with the potency and the availability we have now that we didn't have then. I'm Seth Leibson. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. I am Seth. The number is 602-508-0960. That's 602-5080. 960. Dana's in Chandler. Hi, Dana.
Hi, Seth. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. I wanted to share with you a book that I read fairly recently. It's called Dreamland, and it talks about the drug epidemic and how it got started in this country and how there was this sort of perfect storm created and then how the Mexican cartels took advantage
this
of
this. Is Sam, is this Sam Quinones' book? Is he
oh,
the
God,
author, Sam Quinones?
Author.
Yeah, I think so.
Might be, yeah.
And
it goes into detail about how when medicine implemented the pain scale, you know, when they all say, oh, what's your pain today?
Yep.
You know, rated on a scale of
hospitals,
10.
Yeah.
And that was, yeah, and that was sort of the beginning of the pill mill. And then how those were created and the circumstances surrounding the doctors and the pill mills and kind of Ohio was ground zero. And it goes into how the distribution networks and how it all sort of came to be. And it was a fascinating book. It was quite eye-opening to me anyway, because I didn't know anything about it. But I would recommend that to anybody who's kind of wondering or interested in how the how we got to this point.
It's a partial study, Dana. I've read Sam Quinones for years, and he's not wrong about some of it. It's just that problem is a little dated now when we go about addressing it. So, for example, that used to be a big part of the problem. A big part of the problem was the overprescription and addiction to because of overprescription due to those popular opioid painkillers and how hospitals were reimbursed and incentivized to treat pain. That was a big part of the new drive towards opiates. We were watching drug use increase from other drugs at the same time through the mid to late 90s, cocaine, methamphetamine, other drugs. The opiate issue, the painkiller issue, yes, his etiology of that, his beginnings of that are true enough. But that's kind of changed now, which is why I don't know if you saw in the news, Kristen Gillibrand and Cory Booker are promoting a new piece of federal legislation that would limit doctors to prescribing painkillers to a certain number. I believe it's a 7-day prescription.
Right, you'll just force those people.
Yeah, and I think it's a uniquely bad idea. It's a uniquely bad idea for a few reasons. One is that's not really the problem anymore when we talk about the opioid problem in America. We still have that, but it's about a third of the problem. It's only a third of the problem. Two-thirds of the problem are the illegal illegal opioids, things like fentanyl laced with heroin, illegal fentanyl. It's not the prescription as much as it used to be. Doctors have done a lot better job of not always and not across the board, but a lot better job of understanding what that wrought. And that's not the issue. Is now mostly illegal drugs, illegal fentanyl, illegal heroin, and cocaine. 10,000 cocaine deaths last year. Heroin
and
illegal fentanyl.
Right, and in terms of what they're peddling. So if one thing, you know, goes out of favor, they just introduce something else, or they change it, or they give it a new name. I mean, it's not going
well.
Away.
That's why those
the
of us
we don't talk about is why are people self.
Well, that's why those of us in prevention kind of chafe at just addressing one drug. It's the whole kit and caboodle of substance abuse. And the focus on fentanyl, illegal fentanyl right now is correct. I mean, we're right. It's a huge driver. It's the biggest driver of the overdose deaths. But is anyone talking about the cocaine deaths? Is anyone talking about the 10,000 deaths, 12,000 deaths from cocaine? Is anyone talking about the rise of methamphetamine use again after we got our hands around that a little bit? No. We have to talk about prevention generally. And one of the reasons we who are in the prevention business are so focused on prevention is you look at the other end. It's something I made reference to in the last segment. Those who unfortunately get, you know, into the cycle of substance abuse or addiction, the recovery is so damn hard. It's so very, very hard. You have a lot of relapse. You have a lot of people that don't make it. You have a lot of relapse and relapse and relapse. And that's why we are so focused on
problem.
Never starting. Go ahead.
Well, I guess I'm just curious.
the people that fail, are we only treating the addiction itself? We're not treating the underlying reason why the person is
Well, there's some of that.
Medicating.
There's a lot of that, and there is a lot of that. But the other thing is not to undermine how strong these addictions can be. These are highly addictive substances, and that includes, yes, sometimes people say I don't say enough about alcohol. I don't mean to ignore it either. It's just that, you know, we're not going
to
get rid of it.
Happens to be legal.
Right. I mean, it's not something we're going to make illegal. But
right. We don't talk about caffeine either and how many people are addicted to that.
Well,
I mean,
yes.
I can't go,
but,
I can't function.
Yeah, but the difference there, of course, is, you know, no one's going to tell you that. you can't go driving after a couple of cups of coffee.
No, I understand.
Yeah.
See where it goes.
Yeah.
You...
No, I think the problem that we don't do a good enough job, Dana, at is understanding how addictive these things are and how hard it is to you know, maintain sobriety. I mean, even the best programs, whether they're 12-step or otherwise, you know, a 20% success rate is a good success rate. Good. 20%
right.
is good. That's how hard this stuff is.
But you have 100% success rate of people that never try it.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So one of the great pieces of research that has come along and been validated and re-verified over the years is that if you can get, and Debbie Moak and I talk about this as much as we can, she more than me because she's just more focused on it. But if you can get a child to the age of 21 without ever initiating a substance, the use of a dangerous substance, the chances that they will ever start are as close to zero as you can possibly get. So we keep threatening to write a book called Getting to 21 on how to raise a kid drug-free to the age
great.
Of 21. If we can ever
people.
Find the time to do it, we will write that book. I think it's a good title. But it's a good message for parents. If you can get your kid
for
to age 21 without initiating, the chances they will ever have an addiction or substance abuse problem are basically zero. Basically zero.
Well, and
that has to do with the way the brain,
tunnel.
You know, that just has to do with the way the brain develops in the younger years. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying that would be a great book because for parents it would be a light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, there is, yes.
That
no, that's right.
On the other
that's
end right. You can get there.
No, that's right. That's right. And the thing Debbie wants to, you know, one of the chapters is that Debbie likes to talk about, and she's so right to do it, which is also light at the end of the tunnel for parents, is you don't have to think about it in terms of 21 years. Think about it as year by year. You know, some of these great 12-step programs say one day at a time. Day by day. What we tell parents is just win this year. Just win this year. And and then we'll deal with next year. Dana, great call. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Seth.
God bless you. I'm Seth Liebson. We'll be right back. I've been focusing a lot on a couple of institutions, one of them education and higher education particularly, especially since the scandal and crisis that revealed itself last week with admissions. And I've been just reading a whole bunch of stuff on higher education. This one kind of struck me as interesting. Rockford University philosophy professor Stephen Hicks writes that most of us encountered old-fashioned indoctrinators in our education. Indoctrinators think this way, that there is only one truth. I am in possession of it. So important is it that students must believe it. Alternative ideas are a waste of time and a temptation to unformed minds and should be shunned. So as a teacher, they think I will use my authority and my power to instill only the correct ideas. As George Leaf writes at National Review, unfortunately, many college professors are like that, and those who espouse postmodernism are extremely likely to use their classrooms to train students to be activists rather than to present ideas for them to ponder. Think about AOC for a second. She doesn't really give a smart idea. She gives an activist idea, right? Hicks quotes Duke University professor Franklin Triuccio, who declared that the postmodern educator's task is to train students to spot, confront, and work against the political horrors of one's time. The result is a lot of angry young people who can't wait to do something to fight everything they've been programmed to hate. But because they reject the idea of objective truth, they are ill-equipped to figure out what really merits opposition. The educational malpractice of postmodernism needs to be challenged with every fiber of our being. Go to it, folks. So until tomorrow, class is dismissed.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.